1980 was a banner year for Athens and the University of Georgia, thanks to an 18-year-old freshman whose explosive athletic skills thrilled Bulldog fans from the first day he suited up to play a game.
My God almighty, he ran right through two men. Herschel ran right over two men. They had him dead away inside the nine. Herschel Walker went 16 yards.
Herschel Walker carried Georgia to a 16-15 victory against Tennessee in that first game of the 1980 season. Behind him, the Bulldogs went on to a perfect 12-0 record and were crowned national champions that year. Herschel's magical skills played out in front of nearly 100,000 people who streamed into Sanford Stadium for each game. And television swelled his audiences to millions more. Meanwhile, magical performances of another kind were playing out in front of audiences in much smaller venues in Athens. At joints like the 40 Watt Club, the Uptown Lounge, and others. And in the same way that Herschel focused the eyes of the nation on UGA football, those music venues gave birth to a music scene that soon had the nation looking to Athens as one of the most important rock and roll capitals in the country. The B-52s and REM started in Athens and went on to worldwide acclaim. And to a more selective audience, Pylon was a crucial part of that scene, too. More than 25 years ago, a book called Party Out of Bounds, The B-52s, REM, and the Kids Who Rocked Athens, Georgia, documented the remarkable period of artistic creativity that flourished in Athens from the mid-70s, almost to the end of the century. It quickly became a cult classic.
So I have gotten emails over the years with people saying, I had a copy, but I gave it to my little sister, and I need another one.
That's Roger Lyle Brown, author of Party Out of Bounds. We talked to him just as the University of Georgia Press was publishing a 25th anniversary edition of the book.
I have gotten emails over the years with people saying, I had a copy, but I gave it to my little sister, and I need another one. The most poignant was an email I got from some young lady 15, 20 years ago saying, I was a business major, and I read your book, and I changed my major to graphic design. And I'm like, it's like George Bailey. It's a wonderful, it's like, I changed somebody's life. Without this book, this poor woman would be condemned to be a business major.
I want to go to the 1960s, which you write about before Athens becomes what it's going to become in terms of the rock and roll world. And here's what I'm talking about. You point out that there was a certain restlessness among the student body at Georgia in terms of the music that was being presented to them on campus. So you tell us, for instance, that there came a time when Henry Mancini was scheduled to play a concert at UGA. He canceled. Who took his place?
I don't remember that part.
Iron Butterfly.
Iron Butterfly. Yeah, exactly. So, you know, that was the time. And there were committees that chose the acts. And so if you were of a certain age, certain tastes, and this music was the emerging edgy FM radio album of yours that now Iron Butterfly in a gotta to be good. So that's what they were after. And so that was beginning to lead into the hard rock, you know, the album epic rock and roll. And then it kind of sagged. I do a little cultural analysis that's either flaky or at least just very generic about the post-Vietnam malaise. You know, Jimmy Carter, you know, peace, tranquility, calm down, the war's over, no more protesting, back to the land, Jackson Brown, you know, a lot of mellow hippies out in the woods growing pot. And so that kind of mushy stuff. And then eventually disco started to generate. Suddenly Coke fueled Studio 54 and disco started making its way in. And then the people who were music aficionados began to despise disco as just being repetitive, you know. and there's a lot of debate and controversy over, you know, who were the first punks?
So now we're going to go back to 1976 in Athens, and while we may not know for sure who the first punks were on campus, it's a good bet that Keith Strickland was among them. So was Ricky Wilson. They were about to help form the band that became the B-52s.
In Athens, Keith and Ricky, they were friends in high school, and they played in bands. Ricky was really the musical one.
You point out that Keith Strickland, you describe him when we first meet him in your book. You say, unlike everyone else in town, Keith was into stacked heels of the latest thing, glitter rock. On that spring day, Keith walked the UGA campus in a gold lamé jacket with a Mack truck mirror hung around his neck and his hair jacked out stiff from half a can of Aquanet.
Yeah. You know, everybody's just being normal UGA.
Yeah, we have to remind people that this was the University of Georgia. This was fraternity and sorority heaven.
Right.
These were people wearing button-down collared shirts and khaki slacks and penny loafers. The introduction of Keith, this was a whole new world.
Right. I mean, you know, you look at that context. I mean, it's like University of Georgia was the place where kids from all over the state went. And so very prestigious, sort of the upper middle, upper class. I mean, it was a tradition for them to go. And so they were coming from small towns and they had their small town values.
The B-52s were about to put a big dent in that culture. Keith and Ricky started playing with Fred Schneider, who took lead vocals, and they added Cindy Wilson and Kate Pearson singing backup, at least at first. On stage, they styled themselves as a cross between Woodstock hippie and 1960s suburban cocktail party. The women liked wearing their hair big and poofy in bouffants, which would just add to the joyousness of the band's persona on stage. And then one night, the breakthrough. Valentine's Day, 1977, they're invited to play this party. It's really their coming out. As you point out, they had like six songs. That was their repertoire. And they didn't have a name, and it was for that party that they decided, well, we'll be the B-52s, right?
Yeah, Keith Strickland told the story that he had a dream, it was these women with the hairdos nicknamed B-52, and so they were concerned that it would be interpreted as something violent. I mean, and so that's why they wanted to sort of add that bouffant edge. And so, like, some critics would call it, you know, bouffant bop and stuff like that. And it was unusual at the time. I mean, there were some girl punk bands, but to have women as the front, Fred was there, but the girls they carried the vocals. I mean, and they created all the sound that is distinctive as far as the vocals go, with Ricky coming up with the structure. I think Keith wanted to play guitar originally, but someone had to play drums. And I think Fred could only play the kid's toy piano, so that's what he ended up with.
That Valentine's Day in 1977 was the beginning of what emerged later as Athens is the center of the rock and roll universe. That you could mark that date, because when they played that party, they caused a small sensation that grew rapidly in Athens itself. People clamored to see them perform, yes?
Right. They got a lot of curiosity, and it just happened that there were a couple people there who had come because the art school had a good reputation for painting and other arts. And so there were people that were from out of town, and some were from New York.
And one of those guys from New York said, hey, I know some people. I can get you a gig up there.
So Keith and Ricky, you know, they worked at the bus station, the Greyhound bus station. And they're sitting there toting luggage off the buses and waiting for the call. And, you know, finally, you know, on a payphone in the bus station, getting word that they've got a gig in New York. And that was the goal. Everybody's goal was just to go to New York and play, because you know, they'd heard about CBGBs and Max's and Iggy Pop and Patti Smith.
Yeah, they're really cutting edge clubs, yeah. CBGBs and Max's Kansas City.
And so then they played another party to warm up for this gig that they got, and then they got a station wagon and drove up there and got rave reviews. Came back. I think they played like 5 or 6 shows in Athens before they got a record deal and left town. I mean, it was a cloud of dust. I mean, they just like ignited, and hot on the heels. And I tell the anecdote about the fans, the punk festival that was held in Atlanta, where the fans, an Atlanta band, were very intellectual, very avant-garde, and very dark. And so in contrast, when the Bees came on, the Bees just like had this new dynamic, this new energy, and everybody just like locked into it. And so you had people who had left Athens before suddenly pack up and say, what the hell's going on? And they head on back to Athens and start bands.
It took a while, but they eventually got a record contract. They released a single. Let's listen to a little bit of that first single, Rock Lobster.
We were at the beach. Everybody had matching towels. Somebody went under a dock, and there they saw a rock. It wasn't a rock. What's a rock?
That's the B-52's Rock Lobster. What I love about that song, Roger, is it tells us everything we need to know about the B-52's. That beat, the fun of it. You say in your book, they were embraced, quote, because of their fun, danceability, and anti-intellectual nonsense lyrics. And that song tells us all, right?
Bum, 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 bum. I mean, that's like, that's the structure of their songs, and it's driving, and it's danceable. And so people just... they weren't dancing before, or if they were, it was like just that kind of trippy, flowy, kind of spin around kind of dancing, as opposed to the pogo.
The song, I think I'm right to say, that really made them national stars was Love Shack.
But yeah, Love Shack just broke them and made them eternal.
Yeah. So the B-52s become so big. They become, you tell us in the book, really too big for Athens, and they end up going north. But what they've done is to change the culture, or have been part of the changing culture in Athens. And you have a section of your book that you like to read from that gives us a little sense of what Athens was becoming. You want to share that with us?
Everyone was an artist and could do anything they wanted. They lived in a pretty little Dixie town where in first spring daffodils grew, and in summer bachelor buttons. When the sun was out, tripping young girls with grass seeds stuck to the dew on their calves picked armfuls of flowers and carried them house to house in old coffee cans, escorted along the cracked sidewalks by scarecrow poets who made love to men. When hot, they could drive 5 miles out and find a lake where rednecks never go, where it was cool and okay to hang your clothes on the branches of trees, swim naked at night and have sex al fresco, streaked with mud and sweat, leaving the tall grass soft and broken. These kids, a collection of high school outcasts and precocious talents, felt pretty good about themselves. Athens was like a rock opera version of Lord of the Flies meets Gilligan's Island, where the 21-year-olds can't believe they are no longer 12.
That's Roger Lyle Brown reading from his book, Party Out of Bounds, the B-52s, REM, and the kids who rocked Athens, Georgia. The University of Georgia Press has just published a 25th anniversary edition of the book. We'll take a break and be back with Roger in a moment.
Baby, would you?
Welcome back to Two-Way Street. If you're just joining us, our guest is Roger Lyle Brown. He's the author of Party Out of Bounds. It documents the extraordinary set of circumstances that made Athens one of the most important capitals of rock and roll music in the 80s and 90s. As we pick up our conversation, it's 1981, and the band that's begun making its mark in Athens is Pylon. Unlike the B-52s, Pylon's music is highly structured, almost mathematical in the way their songs develop.
But yeah, they were structured. Michael Lahusky associates that with them, with their part-time jobs at the DuPont factory.
I love that story.
Where
tell us about that.
It's if you go into a manufacturing environment, everything is precise. There are guide tapes on the floor that you follow. You can't cross this line or that line. There's the rhythm of the machines. And it's precision machining. And so they were influenced by that kind of concept. And they were very conceptual. They were art students. And then they needed a singer. And they tried out a couple singers who, you know, might work conceptually as front people, male, female, but just didn't click. And then they asked Vanessa, who they worked with, Vanessa Briscoe, hey. And the way Lahusky tells it is they thought, being a structured band, that there was a structure, a pattern to the lyrics. They had to hit the right, you know, on the beat kind of thing. And when she didn't really have that much experience, she just started, you know, howl singing the lyrics in these like broken patterns. And they thought that was just an incredible contrast about her intense, almost primal scream type approach.
With their structured music.
With their structured music. You had this precise, very, I mean, elegant in a way, with the guitar and bass. And then you had this gorgeous chanteuse country girl banshee and this jackhammer drummer.
And that's
a great combination, and it made their sound.
Pylon's first single was called Cool. Let's listen to just a little of that. Singing Cool. B-52s had already become big on the national scene. Pylon comes along, and suddenly the national rock and roll media suddenly begins to realize that there's something happening in Athens. You have a copy of New York Rocker. The cover is a story about Pylon.
Yeah, the cover is Pylon. It's March of 1981. And to get in the New York Rocker was like, oh my God. I mean, it's the cover of Time or something like that. But this was a sensation. And it's like Pylon from Athens, Georgia, new sounds of the Old South. And if you look inside, there's a spread, small town makes good, 19 hours from New York.
And one of the bands in that New York Rocker article is a group called REM. Their lead singer was a guy named Michael Stipe. He'd moved to Athens from St. Louis in 1977 and didn't much like it there at first. But he formed a band with Bill Berry, Mike Mills, and Peter Buck, and more than any band before them, put Athens on the map as one of the most influential music towns in the world. They burst onto the national scene with their first single, Radio Free Europe.
Thank you.
Radio Free Europe. What did that record do for them?
That got them rave reviews in the Village Voice and all the different magazines. So they had good blurbs to put on their posters, and so they made like, that was their single, and then Chronic Town, their EP came out, and that just kind of solidified it. And quickly on the heels came Murmur in 83, and that's still considered like probably one of the top 100 American albums. But they started alt rock of, with the folk influence. It's become a little cliched and tired and, all this kind of stuff, because people have been dissecting it now for decades. Peter's arpeggio guitar and Michael's cryptic lyrics, sometimes he was just saying his voice was another instrument. So, it's like, and people would not, make up their own lyrics to the songs and things like that. But
well, and of course we know that R.E.M. went on to become one of the greatest bands ever. Rolling Stone called them that, the greatest rock and roll band. Interesting, isn't it, Roger, that the response that Mike Mills had, I think it was Mike Mills, was, no, we're not the greatest rock and roll band, Pylon is. I thought that was an interesting comment.
Yeah, that's one of the great things about R.E.M. is that, and they stayed in Athens, and they've given back a lot to Athens as far as, preservation and good causes and support for other artists.
You take us through this wonderful story, starting really with the B-52s, moving us all the way through REM, and a period of time during which Athens became truly the center of the rock and roll universe. What's the Athens music scene like today?
I'm not glad you asked me that, though. I don't really know.
Okay.
I'll tell you this. No, my only analogy, It's a Wonderful Life. It's like, it's the version of Bedford Falls if George Bailey had not lived, with the blinking neon and the debauchery and the rowdy. And I think it is quantifiably the densest entertainment district in the country, more bars, restaurants, and I think the Hope Scholarship is really influence that, because you've got all these students staying in state and not really having to work, but having a lot of discretionary income. Because I've had people tell me, hey, if you get the Hope, then your college fund we've been saving for will buy you a car and give you money. And so you've got lots of restaurants and everybody's eating out. I mean, we were lucky to know a waiter at the pizza place who would give us the crusts off of tables they were bussing.
As we leave, could I ask you to read a section of the book that I think really, it's the very end of your book, and I think it sums up beautifully what your whole book talks about. Would you be willing to read that section?
Yeah, because everybody, the thing about it is everybody say, what was it? What's the magic thing? And there's no one cause. I mean, so I said, nobody ever did figure it out. They couldn't. There was nothing to figure out. The reason Athens, Georgia saw the birth of the most notable American rock scene in the 1980s wasn't because of the red clay, the water, or the sweat. It wasn't the cheap rent, the art school, or the availability of beer and LSD. It was simply the dynamic of exceptional coincidence. It was the initial coincidence that led the B-52s to meet, get drunk, play, have taste and talent, and then themselves meet the right people at the right historical moment and play New York when the dark town needed a blast of color and light. Following that, there was the coincidence that LaHusky met Bewley, met Crow, met Briscoe, met Fred, met Danny, met Dana, met Vic, met Gamble, met on up to Buck, meeting Stipe, meeting Kathleen, meeting Bill, meeting Mike, meeting Jefferson, meeting Sandy, meeting, and on and on, and continuing even today in a great chain of ongoing and ceaseless begettings. Call it coincidence or call it magic, whatever you call it, it wasn't the water.
Roger Lyle Brown's book, Party Out of Bounds, has been selected as the first read in a new virtual book club. It's called Georgia Reads, and it's just been launched as a partnership between UGA Press and Georgia Public Broadcasting. If you check out the Two-Way Street website at gpb.org/TWS or go to our Facebook page. You'll find links to the GPB page that features lots of material about the club and about how you can get involved. And you'll find information about a Georgia Reads event that'll take place on Saturday, March 18th. Roger Brown will join Pylon singer Vanessa Briscoe-Hay for a panel discussion on the local music scene in Athens. We're going to take another break right now. Back in a moment. Welcome back to Two-Way Street. I'm Bill Nigut. So where are you right now? Sitting in your kitchen realizing you haven't a clue what you're going to fix for your family for dinner? Or maybe you're stuck in traffic and are running late for a hair appointment. This is probably a good time to start dreaming about getting away, planning your summer vacation. And we want to help. Instead of giving you tips on hot new destinations, scoring cheap airline tickets, or listing the top restaurants in a dozen travel destinations, we want to talk with you about rethinking how you travel. That's the focus of travel writer Thomas Swick's new book, The Joys of Travel. If you take Swick's advice, maybe you'll decide not to stand in a long line waiting to tour the New York Stock Exchange or Chicago Shedd Aquarium or the Taj Mahal. Instead, you might find yourself getting lost in a maze of alleyways, dining with a local family, or simply sitting in a park watching locals playing a game you've never seen before. Tom Swick, thank you for being here for Two-Way Street. I really enjoyed reading The Joys of Travel, your new book.
Thank you very much.
People are always excited by the notion of being a travel writer. You, some time ago, wrote a piece, I think it was for the Missouri Review.
Yes.
In which you said your dream had been to be a travel writer. But you said this: travel writers understand that there is a catch. The nature of our work necessitates that we disobey one of the oldest rules of the game: write what you know. Journalists have beats, cops, schools, foods, movies they develop a deep understanding of over time. The beat of a travel writer is the world, and essentially you say you can't know going in what you're going to write about.
Yeah, we go out, and half the time we don't have a clue. I use this example sometimes. When I go to Asia particularly, I feel really kind of out of my depth. Obviously, I don't speak the language in any of the Asian countries I've been to. I walk down the street and I see people eating on the sidewalk, and I look in the bowls and I can't even identify what's in their bowls, you know. And I think, how can I know what these people are thinking? I don't even know what they're eating. So I feel very clueless, and I wonder, how can I write anything about this place? But then I come home and I have lunch with a friend, and he starts asking me questions about my trip, and I start telling him things, and he's going, really? And I realize I know more than he does, because I've been there.
When I read quite a few travel articles, they're the best hits of a given city. If you're visiting Albuquerque, here are the top five sites to see. Here are the Mexican restaurants that will give you the most authentic experience. And I think that leads to a question that you have discussed, which is, when you go to see a new destination or revisit one, you go for the experience of being there and not going from point to point, but you believe in being able to wander through a community, see the people, go to the places that everybody isn't talking about, really experience and live in that place. Is that right?
When I arrive in the place, the first thing I do is walk, especially a foreign city or foreign country. Everything stands out in those first few hours. It's almost like seeing the world in high definition. So you walk and walk and just wander. You know, don't plan to see anything, but just stroll and kind of get lost in the place. After you walk, though, you get tired, so you sit. And sitting's important, because when you take yourself out of, if you're in a city, you take yourself out of the crowd and sit down in a cafe, Now you can watch the people better. When you're part of that crowd, you're not so observant. So you sit and you watch how the people greet each other. You know, do they kiss? Do they shake hands? How many kisses? You know, all that. You observe that while you're sitting. And then the third step, which is the most difficult but the most rewarding, is to somehow try to participate in the life of the place. And that involves meeting people. And I don't feel that a trip has been successful unless I make contact with at least one local. And again, it doesn't have to be somebody who's representative of the place. It's just the person I meet.
It surprises me that one of the things you say in your book is that most of the time, as a travel writer, I'm wandering around lonely and aimless.
Yes.
What did you mean by that?
Well, those are the things I don't write about usually in my stories because nobody wants to hear about that. But it's true. I mean, the travel writer most of the time is that we were saying earlier, looking for something to happen, but nothing is happening a lot of the time. And I find, too, it often takes a while. You know, those first couple days, I always wonder, has my luck run out? You know, have I used up all my good karma and met great people on other trips? In this place, it's not going to happen. But often it does, but you have to work at it. That trip to Portugal taught me, because all through Spain, which I'd been to before that I went to Portugal, I just went to the tourist cities and I just was around tourists and I was eating meals by myself. And I realized this is not going to produce an interesting travel mm-hmm. story. And then when I got to Portugal, I met this Dutch woman because I said, I have to talk to somebody. And I went to the University of Coimbra and I went to the English department and I accosted the first person I saw coming up the steps. And it happened to be a Dutch woman. But again, she put me in touch with a Portuguese person. But yeah, a lot of it is wandering around because I most travel writers travel alone. You know, it's very hard to write about a place and travel with a companion. You want to be free of all distractions, and you're not when you're with somebody else. You are distracted, so you're lonely, and you see all these other people who aren't who aren't alone. And cities aren't so bad because cities are full of all kinds of people. But if you go to a kind of a touristy place, a resort or something, in the summer, you go to the south of France. Mm-hmm. Well, and you're wandering around alone. You're one of the few who's wandering around alone, and you notice that.
Yeah. Let's talk about the seven stages. We won't cover all seven of them, but since your book is about the seven stages of travel, your first one just resonates, I think, with everyone who is out on planning a big trip, anticipation. Talk about anticipation and why it's so important.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think everybody does acknowledge anticipation. I'm not sure we savor as much as we could, but yeah, that feeling that you've got something coming, you know, you've got it. I find that if I'm feeling a little low, it's because I have no trips planned. And as soon as I buy tickets, and it could be 6 months in advance, I have something now to look forward to. And as a traveler, I do a lot of the anticipation really translates into preparation. I do a lot of reading about a place, and I really recommend other travelers do that too, not just the guidebooks, but I read novels that are set in the place to get the atmosphere.
You talk about movement. You quote Robert Louis Stevenson, "I travel not to go anywhere, but to go. I travel for travel's sake. The great affair is to move." And that's really true also, isn't it?
It is, but I think this is one of the joys, probably the joy that's the least appreciated. I don't think many people, as they're leaving the house and going off on a trip, are thinking of the joy they're going to get from getting there. So many of us fly places nowadays, and all we can anticipate is the hassles of security and then the discomfort of being in close proximity with strangers for however many hours. But I argue in the book that even flying can give you real moments of pleasure. You know, you're caught in this wonderful limbo between past and future, you know, the deadlines of departure and the chaos of arrival. You have this breathing space and you're, you know, 30,000 feet up and you can look out at the clouds. And even flying can be a moment of pleasure.
You do have a hierarchy of methods of travel. So, for instance, you say in the book, trains are better than buses.
Yes.
And you point out that Paul Thoreau, one of the great, great travel writers, has written extensively about train travel. Why are trains better than buses?
Well, you can get up and walk around. You can get up and move. Buses don't have dining cars. And even though the last time I took Amtrak, the food wasn't anything memorable, just the idea of just the act of sitting in the dining car and looking up from your breakfast and seeing the world pass by. You know, you go through these little towns where, you know, everything. I make the point in the book that most travel is an escape. And planes and ships take you away from the world and surround you with emptiness, you know, the sky and the water. But a train is a remarkable thing because it takes you out of the fray while taking you right through it, you know. And you can look out the window and there, just inches away, is life is going on as you know it. You know, you see kids in a schoolyard and you see dogs barking at mail trucks and everything there. And it's almost like, you know, that fantasy of dying and looking down on the action.
And yet, because you can move around and go to a bar car, a dining car, you're in a self-contained community that is moving through and yet of the people who you're passing by.
Right. And a lot of the people who take trains are real train buffs. I mean, they're there because of a real love of train travel. And you have, if you're one of them, it's almost like traveling in a little secret society. You all share that love of trains. And one nice thing about the dining cars on Amtrak is that, I assume they still do this, when you come to the dining car, they just sit you, they fill up the tables one by one. So they won't just sit you at an empty table. They'll sit you with other people. And it's great. You talk to people and you meet strangers. And that's the other joy of train travel. It's very conducive to conversation. Yeah.
What do you think about cruise ships?
You know, I love ships. I'm not a big cruise. I used to take a cruise every year as part of my job as a travel editor. And I'm not a big cruiser, but I love the experience of being on the ship. You know, you walk across the gangway and you get on board and all of a sudden that's your world and the rest of the world disappears. And I say in the book it's the most sensual form of travel because, you know, you not only see and feel and hear, but you stand outside and that salt air, you can taste and you can smell your progress across the globe. And I'm happy that the popularity of cruising has kept the ship alive.
But the cruise industry seems to have increasingly done everything it can to present you with accommodations and distractions to make it so that you don't even feel like you are out at sea.
That's true. And many people don't take advantage of that, which to me, I think, is the great pleasure of cruising, just being at sea. But there's a trend now to reverse that. I was on a ship last year, an inaugural cruise of a Norwegian cruise line ship, and a lot of the restaurants now have set up tables out on the outside tables on the decks. So people are kind of rediscovering that beauty of being outside at sea.
Well, one of the things about a cruise ship leads me to something else that you've talked about in the book, which is essentially your feeling about people who go on tours, who do package tours when they go to a new destination. You're not a fan of tours particularly. And yet, for an awful lot of people, a tour package reduces all of the headaches, all the complexities that setting out on your own inevitably forces you to deal with. Yes,
that's true. And My parents used to love taking tours, you know, that, and again, exactly for the reasons you say, they didn't have to think about things, and it was a very enjoyable kind of travel. But it's not for me.
You talk in the book about the fact that it's a lie that has been perpetuated, that everything now looks the same wherever you go. Is that a lie?
Yeah, it is. It is. People say that because they go, you know, they travel thousands of miles to another continent and they see Starbucks or they see McDonald's and they say, well, look at that. It's just like home. It's not. You know, if you go in the McDonald's in Madrid, for example, it's very different from your McDonald's back home. It's usually more elegant. They probably serve wine, which you don't get in the States. So, the world has adapted a lot of American brands and American institutions, but put their own spin on them. The trick in travel now is to be alert to the nuances. You know, look a little deeper into what you're seeing. And also to kind of try to keep that childlike sense of wonder.
All right, we're coming close to being out of time. Can I ask you to do a little, you like to write in context, in depth. You don't like to do the usual tourist lists and stuff. But can we do a little of that before
okay.
we leave?
Sure.
Okay, so right now, if I'm planning a trip, let's say I want to stay in the United States.
Yeah.
Would you give me a couple destinations that you think I may overlook but I shouldn't?
Okay. Well, you know, I often tell people the South, but you're in Atlanta, so that may not be appropriate for you. But
why would you send people to Atlanta?
Why would I send them to Atlanta? I think Atlanta is a fascinating city. It's a regional capital. You know, it is the capital of the South. And it's every time I come here, I'm impressed by new neighborhoods, restaurants, cafes. It's just I find it to be a very dynamic city.
Okay, so what are a couple other cities that you might recommend that we might not think about?
In the South or elsewhere?
No,
anywhere
around
in
the country.
I really like the Midwest. And not so much for the cities, except for Chicago, which is a great city, especially for students of architecture, because that's where the American skyscraper
my hometown.
Is it? Yeah, Chicago's a great city. But I like Iowa. I've traveled a couple times in Iowa, and the first time I went, I was just amazed at all the little bits of Americana that you find everywhere. I flew into Des Moines, I rented a car, and I drove north to a town called Clear Lake, which is where Buddy Holly had his last concert before the plane crash. And they had it in the Surf Ballroom. And the Surf Ballroom is kept exactly as it was the night of that concert. And they still, every year, they do a memorial for Buddy Holly. I think it was also, there were two other musicians with him. And then just down the road is a town called Britt. And Britt has the National Hobo Convention every summer. And when I was there, this was in the mid-90s, a lot of the hobos were retired. They were coming now in their RVs. But it was a really nice event. And there was one guy who rode trains out from California. His nickname was Cardboard because he set up these little cardboard huts where he would sleep. And then I drove east toward Dubuque and just outside Dubuque you have the Field of Dreams. And the field is there, you know, the cornfield and the baseball field, and you know, fathers were pitching balls to their sons, and it was a really it's a lovely area. Grant Wood is from a little south of there, and then Iowa City is a great university town with a great bookstore. So I really like the Midwest. It is the heartland. It is the kind of where America, I think, the best of America, I think, is
that's a great little trip.
It is. So, I mean, you can always find these little out-of-the-way places with interesting histories.
What about Europe? Are there out-of-the-way, undiscovered parts of Europe at this point, or is everything known?
No, I think there are out-of-the-way places. even in very popular countries like France. I spent a summer working on a farm in Alsace, the northeast part of France, caught between France and Germany. And not many tourists go to Alsace. You know, Americans go to Provence or Normandy or Brittany or the wine country. But Alsace is, and it's this interesting area because it's the language, they speak their own language, Alsatian, but it's a German, it's definitely based on, more on German than, it's not a Romance language. And the people there are mostly trilingual. You know, I was working on a farm. I was, you know, struggling to learn my second language, French. And I was working with these farmers who had no problem going from Alsatian to German to French. And the food, you know, they have wonderful wines. They have, you know, Riesling and some other really good wines. The food is excellent, you know, sauerkraut and sausages. And it's a great area of France, but again, not that many Americans visit there. Portugal for years has been kind of off to the side. You don't pass through Portugal. You have to make an effort to go there. And it's one of my favorite countries in the world. I've been 3 times. It's now being discovered. I think a lot of people are getting a little worried about terrorism and all the social problems in Northern Europe. And Portugal seems removed from all that. So I think you see more and more articles now about Portugal.
How do you speak to people about those concerns when they're planning trips to parts of the world that have been affected by terrorism?
Well, I mean, you just basically tell them to look at the statistics. I mean, the chances of being a victim of an attack like we saw in Paris, I think, are so slim. And, you know, that sort of thing can happen to you in your own home because we have attacks here. Not necessarily terrorism attacks, but we have other problems. So, I tell people that if they're too worried about it, then probably you shouldn't go because that's going to ruin the trip if you're anxious all the time. But try to realize that, chances are nothing's going to happen
okay.
to you.
Finally, you've been very generous with your time. So finally, a last question. Do you have a favorite spot in the world?
No, I have spots. Poland, yes, that would be my favorite spot because I have so much invested in Poland. I lived 2.5 years there. My wife is Polish. So yeah, when I go back to Poland, it's almost like going home in a way. So that's the one place in all the world that stands out for me. But as far as places, I say in the book that I've felt that emotional connection. There are a handful, and they include Portugal, Vietnam, where I had a wonderful trip in 94. The people were incredibly hospitable. The same in Turkey. I felt like a guest everywhere I went in Turkey. I also love very much Mexico. I've been to Mexico probably 6 times and always had good experiences.
Mexico City or the
coast? I've been
coast
to Mexico City once, and then I've been to the Yucatan, okay. and then more recently San Miguel and okay. Guanajuato, Brazil, yeah. and Lithuania. I like Lithuania very much.
You have eclectic tastes, Thomas Swick. Your book is Joys of Travel. We're going to post a link on our website at gpb.org/TWS to give people more information about the book. And we'll also direct them to your website where they can learn more, a little bit more about you and also look at some of the essays that you've written for various magazines. But best of luck with this book. And thank you so much for visiting with us today. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks, Bill. I really enjoyed it.
You can learn more about Thomas Swick's book, The Joys of Travel, at our website and on the Two Way Street Facebook page. That's all the time we have for this week. Our senior producer is the musically mellifluous Jenny Ammon. Our producer is the audibly assertive Lisa Clark. I'm Bill Nygut. See you again next week for another Two Way Street.